He went into the bathroom and opened the medicine cabinet. He found a box of paracetamol painkillers and a half-full tube of cytidone, paracetamol with codeine. Cytidone was a prescription drug. The medicine was prescribed for Miriam Wu. There was one toothbrush in the medicine cabinet.
"Fasty, why does it say Salander Wu on the door?"
he said.
"No idea." "Okay. Let me put it this way. Why is there mail on the doormat addressed to a Miriam Wu? Why is there a prescription tube of cytidone in the medicine cabinet made out to Miriam Wu? Why is there only one toothbrush? And why, when you consider that Lisbeth Salander is, according to our information, only one hand's breadth tall, do those leather pants you're holding up fit a person who is at least 5'8"?"
There was a brief, embarrassed silence in the apartment. It was broken by Anderson.
"Shit," he said.
Chapter 15. Maundy, Thursday, March 24th. Mom felt drained and miserable when he finally got home after the unplanned day at work. He smelled the aroma of something spicy from the kitchen and went in and hugged his boyfriend.
"How are you feeling?" Arnold Magnusson asked.
"Like a sack of shit.
I've been hearing about it on the news all day long. They haven't released the names yet, but it sounds fucking awful."
"It is fucking awful. Dag worked for us. He was a friend, and I liked him a lot. I didn't know his girlfriend, but both Mika and Erika did."
Mom looked around the kitchen. They had moved into the apartment on Allhelgonagarten only 3 months ago. Suddenly it felt like another world. The telephone rang. They looked at each other and decided to ignore it. Then the answering machine switched on and they heard a familiar voice.
"Krista? Are you there? Pick up."
It was Berger, calling to tell him that the police were now looking for Blomqvist's former researcher, who was the prime suspect for the murder of Svensson and Johansson. Mom received the news with a sense of unreality. Cortez had missed the commotion on Lundegarten for the simple reason that he had been standing outside the police press office at Kungsholmen the whole time, from which no news had been released since the press conference earlier that afternoon. He was tired, hungry, and annoyed at being ignored by the people he was trying to contact. Not until 6, when the raid at Salander's apartment was over, did he pick up a rumour that the police had a suspect in the investigation. The tip came from a colleague at an evening paper, but Cortez soon managed to find out Prosecutor Ekstrom's mobile phone number. He introduced himself and asked his questions about who, how, and why.
"What newspaper did you say you were from?" Ekstrom said.
"Millennium Magazine. I knew one of the victims. I understand that the police are looking for a specific person. Can you confirm this?"
"I can't comment at present."
"Can you say when you will be able to provide some concrete information?"
"We may well call another press conference later this evening."
Ekstrom sounded evasive. Cortez tugged on the gold ring in his earlobe.
"Press conferences are for reporters who have immediate deadlines. I work for a monthly magazine, and we have a very special personal interest in knowing what progress is being made."
"I can't help you. You'll have to be patient, like everyone else."
"According to my source, it's a woman who is wanted for questioning. Who is she?"
"I can't comment just now."
"Can you confirm that you're searching for a woman?"
"I'm not going to confirm or deny anything at all. Goodbye."
Holmberg stood in the doorway of the bedroom and contemplated the huge pool of blood on the floor where Mia Johansson had been found. He turned and could see a similar pool of blood where Svensson had lain. He pondered the extensive blood loss. It was a lot more blood than he was used to finding at shootings. Supervisor Mortensen had been correct in his assessment that the killer had used hunting ammo. The blood had coagulated in a black and rusty brown mass that covered so much of the floor that the ambulance personnel and technical team had to walk through it, leaving footprints throughout the apartment. Holmberg was wearing gym shoes with blue plastic booties over them. The real crime scene investigation began, in his view, now. The bodies of the victims had been removed. Holmberg was there by himself after the two remaining techs had said good night and left. They had photographed the victims and measured blood splatter on the walls and conferred about splatter distribution areas and droplet velocity. Holmberg had not paid much attention to the technical examination. The crime scene tech's findings would be compiled in a report which would reveal in detail where the killer had stood in relation to his victims and at what distance, in which order the shots had been fired, and which fingerprints might be of interest. But for Holmberg it was of no interest at all. The technical examination would not contain a syllable about who the killer was or what motive he, or she, a woman was now the prime suspect, might have had for the murders. Those were the questions he now had to try to answer. Holmberg went into the bedroom. He put a worn briefcase on a chair and took out a dictaphone, a digital camera, and a notebook. He began by going through the chest of drawers behind the bedroom door. The two top drawers contained women's underwear, sweaters, and a jewellery box. He arranged each object on the bed and scrutinized the jewellery box. He did not think it contained any pieces of great value. In the bottom drawer he found two photograph albums and two folders containing household accounts. He turned on his tape recorder.
Confiscation protocol for Bjørn Borgsvegen 8B. Bedroom, chest of drawers, bottom bureau drawer. Two bound photograph albums, size A4. One folder with black spine marked Household and one folder with blue spine marked Financial Documents, containing information about a mortgage and loans for the apartment. A small box containing handwritten letters, postcards and personal items.
He carried the objects to the hall and placed them in a suitcase. He continued with the drawers in the bedside tables on each side of the double bed, finding nothing of interest. He opened the wardrobes and sorted through clothes, feeling in each pocket and in the shoes to check for any forgotten or hidden objects, and then turned his attention to the shelves at the top of the wardrobes. He opened boxes and small storage containers. Every so often he found papers or items that he would include for various reasons in the confiscation inventory. There was a desk in one corner of the bedroom. It was a very small home office, with a desktop compact computer and an old monitor. Under the desk was a two-drawer filing cabinet, and on the floor next to the desk stood a low shelf unit. Holmberg knew that it would be in this home office that he would probably make the most important finds, to the extent that there was anything to find, and so he saved the desk for last. Instead, he went into the living room and continued the crime scene inspection. He opened the glass-fronted cabinet and examined each bowl, each drawer, each shelf. Then he turned his attention to the large bookcase along the outer wall and the wall of the bathroom. He took a chair and began at the top, checking whether anything was hidden on top of the bookcase. Then he went down it shelf by shelf, quickly picking out stacks of books and going through them, also checking whether anything was concealed behind them on the shelves. After 45 minutes he put the last book back on the shelf. On the living room table was a neat stack of books. He turned on the tape recorder.
From the bookcase in the living room, a book by Mikhail Blomqvist, the Mafia's banker, a book in German entitled Der Staat und die Autonomen, a book in Swedish with the title Revolutionary Terrorism, and an English book, Islamic Jihad.
He included the book by Blomqvist because its author had turned up in the preliminary investigation. The last three works were perhaps less obvious. Holmberg had no idea whether the murders were related to any form of political activity, or indeed whether Svensson and Johansson was politically involved, or whether the books were merely indicative of a general interest in politics as part of their academic or journalistic work. On the other hand, if two dead bodies were found in an apartment where there were books about terrorism, he was going to make note of the fact. He placed the books in the suitcase with the other items. Then he looked through the drawers in an antique desk. On top of the desk was a CD player, and the drawers contained a great number of CDs. Holmberg spent half an hour opening every CD case and verifying that the contents matched the cover. He found about 10 CDs that had no label and were probably burned at home, or possibly pirated copies. He inserted the ones without labels into the CD player to check that they were not storing anything besides music. He examined the TV shelf nearest the bedroom door, where there was a large collection of video cassettes. He test-played several of them. They seemed to be everything from action movies to a hodgepodge of taped news programs and reports from Cold Facts, Insider, and Assignment Scrutiny. He added 36 video cassettes to the inventory. Then he went to the kitchen, opened a thermos of coffee, and took a short break before he went on with his search. From a shelf in a kitchen cupboard he gathered a number of jars and medicine bottles. They too were placed in a plastic bag and added to the confiscated material.
He picked out foodstuffs from the pantry and refrigerator and opened every jar, coffee package, and re-corked bottle. In a pot sitting on the windowsill, he found 1,220 kroner, plus some receipts. From the bathroom he took nothing, but he did observe that the laundry basket was overflowing. He went through all the clothing. He took coats out of a closet in the hall and searched in every pocket. He found Svensson's wallet in the inner pocket of a sports jacket and added it to the inventory of confiscated items. Svensson had a membership card to the Friskis and Svettis gym chain, a Handelsbanken ATM card, and just under 400 kroner in cash. He found Johansson's handbag and spent a few minutes going through its contents. She also had a card to Friskis and Svettis, an ATM card, a Consum Co-op loyalty card, and a membership card to something called Club Horizon, which had a globe as its logo. He found about 2,500 kroner in cash, a relatively large but not unreasonable sum, given that they were on their way out of Stockholm for the holiday weekend. That there was money in their wallets did reduce the likelihood of their deaths being robbery-related. From Johansson's handbag found on the shelf above the coat rack in the hall, one pro-plan pocket diary, a separate address book, and a leather-bound black notebook. Holmberg took another break for coffee and noted that, for a change, he had so far found nothing embarrassing or intimate in the Svensson-Johansson couple's home. No hidden sex aids, no scandalous underwear, no drawer full of pornographic videos, no marijuana cigarettes, or any sign at all of other illegal substances. They seemed to be a normal couple. Possibly, from a police standpoint, somewhat duller than average. Finally he returned to the bedroom and sat down at the desk. He opened the top drawer. He soon found that the desk and shelf unit next to it contained extensive source and reference materials for Johansson's doctoral thesis From Russia with Love. The material was neatly arranged, exactly like a police report, and he lost himself for a while in certain sections of the text. Mia Johansson was good enough to be on the force, he told himself. One section of the bookshelf was only half full and seemed to contain material belonging to Svensson, mainly press clippings of his own articles and others on subjects that had interested him. Holmberg spent a while going through the computer and found that it held almost 5 gigabytes, everything from software to letters and downloaded articles and PDF files. Certainly he was not going to be able to read through it in one evening. He added the computer and assorted CDs and a zip drive with about 30 discs to the confiscated items. Then he sat brooding for a while. The computer contained Johansson's work as far as he could see. Svensson was a journalist, and a computer ought to be his most important tool, but he did not even get email on the desktop. So he must have had a computer somewhere else. Holmberg got up and went through the apartment, thinking. In the hall there was a black backpack with some notebooks that belonged to Svensson, and an empty compartment for a computer. He could not find a laptop anywhere in the apartment. He took the keys and went down to the courtyard and searched Johansson's car and then the apartment's basement storage area. He found no computer there either. "The strange thing about the dog is that it did not bark, my dear Watson." He made a note that at least one computer seemed to be missing. Poblansky and Fuster met Ekström in his office at 6:30 p.m., soon after they returned from Lundegarten. Andersson, after calling in, had been sent to Stockholm University to interview Johansson's tutor about her doctoral thesis. Holmberg was still in Enschede, and Mudig was running the crime scene investigation at Odenplan. 10 hours had passed since Poblansky was appointed leader of the investigative team, and 7 hours since the hunt for Salander had begun. "And who is Miriam Wu?" Ekström said.
"We don't know much about her yet. She has no criminal record. It'll be Fasti's task to start looking for her first thing tomorrow morning. But as far as we could see, there's no sign that Salander lives at Lundegarten. For one thing, all the clothes in the wardrobe were the wrong size for her."
"And they weren't your typical clothes, either," Fasti said.
"Meaning what?" Ekström asked.
"Well, let's just say they weren't the type of clothes you'd buy for Mother's Day."
"We know nothing about the Wu woman at present," Poblansky said.
"How much do you have to know, for God's sake? She has a closet full of whore outfits."
"Whore outfits?" Ekström said.
Back leather, patent leather, corsets and fetishist whips and sex toys in a drawer. They didn't look like cheap stuff either.
Are you saying that Miriam Wu is a prostitute?
We know nothing about Fröken Wu at this stage,
Bublansky said a little more sharply. One of Salander's social welfare reports indicated a few years ago that she was involved in prostitution, Ekstrom said.
And social welfare usually knows what they're talking about,
Fasti said.
The social welfare report was not supported by any police reports,
Bublansky said.
There was an incident in Tantalunden when she was 16 or 17. She was in the company of a considerably older man. Later the same year she was arrested for being drunk in public, again with a considerably older man.
You mean that we shouldn't draw conclusions too hastily, Ekstrom said. Okay. But it strikes me that Johansson's thesis, having been on trafficking and prostitution, there's a possibility that in her work she made contact with Salander and this Wu and in some way provoked them, and that this might somehow constitute a motive for murder.
Johansson might have got in touch with Salander's guardian and started the whole merry-go-round,
Fasti said.
That's possible, Bublansky said, but the investigation will have to document that. The important thing for now is to find Salander. She's obviously no longer living on Lundegarten. That means we also have to find Wu and discover how she came to live in that apartment, and what her relationship with Salander is.
And how do we find Salander?
She's out there somewhere. The problem is that the only address she ever had was on Lundegarten. No change of address was filed.
You're forgetting that she was also admitted to St. Stephen's, and lived with various different foster families.
I'm not forgetting.
Bublansky checked his papers.
She had 3 separate foster families when she was 15. It didn't go well. From just before she turned 16 until she was 18, she lived with a couple in Hägersten, Frederick and Monica Gullberg. Anderson is going out to see them this evening when he's finished at the university.
How are we doing on the press conference? Fasti said. The mood in Berger's office at 7 that evening was grim. Blomqvist had been sitting silent and almost immobile ever since Inspector Bublansky had left. Ericsson had cycled over to Lundegarten to watch what was going on there. She reported that no one seemed to have been arrested and that traffic was flowing once again. Cortez had called in to tell them that the police were now looking for a second, unnamed woman. Berger told him the name. Berger and Ericsson had talked through what needed to be done. But the immediate situation was complicated by the fact that Blomqvist and Berger knew what role Salander had played in the denouement of the Wennerström affair. In her capacity as elite-level hacker, she had been Blomqvist's secret source. Ericsson had no knowledge of this, and had never even heard Salander's name mentioned, so the conversation occasionally lapsed into cryptic silences.
"I'm going home," Blomqvist said, getting up abruptly. "I'm so tired I can't think straight. I've got to get some sleep. Tomorrow being Good Friday, I plan to sleep and go through papers. Marlin, can you work over Easter?"
"Do I have a choice?"
"No. We'll start at noon on Saturday. Could we work at my place rather than in the office?"
"That would be fine."
"I'm thinking of revamping the approach that we decided on this morning. Now it's no longer just a matter of trying to find out if Doug's exposé had something to do with the murders. It's about working out from the material who murdered Doug and Mia."
Ericsson wondered how they were going to go about doing any such thing, but she said nothing. Blomqvist waved goodbye to the two of them and left without another word. At 7:15, Inspector Bublansky reluctantly followed Prosecutor Ekstrom onto the podium in the police press centre. Bublansky had absolutely no interest in being in the spotlight in front of a dozen TV cameras. He was almost panic-stricken to be the focus of such attention. He would never get used to or begin to enjoy seeing himself on television. Ekstrom, on the other hand, moved with ease, adjusted his glasses, and adopted a suitably serious expression. He let the photographers take their pictures before he raised his hands and asked for quiet.
"I'd like to welcome you all to this somewhat hastily arranged press conference regarding the murders in Enschede late last night. We have some more information to share with you. My name is Prosecutor Richard Ekstrom, and this is Criminal Inspector Jan Bublansky of the County Criminal Police Violent Crimes Division, who is leading the investigation. I have a statement to read, and then there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions."
Ekstrom looked at the assembled journalists. The murders in Enschede were big news and getting bigger. He was pleased to note that Aktuelt, Rapport, and TV4 were all there, and he recognized reporters from the TT wire service and the evening and morning papers. There were also quite a few reporters he did not recognize. As you know, two people were murdered in Enschede last night. A weapon was found at the crime scene, a Colt 45 Magnum. Today the National Forensics Laboratory established that this gun was the murder weapon. The owner of the weapon was identified, and we went looking for him today. Ekstrom paused for effect. At 4:15 this afternoon, the owner of the weapon was found dead in his apartment in the vicinity of Odenplan. He had been shot. He is believed to have been dead at the time of the killings in Enschede. The police, Ekstrom here gestured towards Bublansky, have reason to believe that the same person was responsible for all three murders. A murmur broke out among the reporters. Several of them began talking in low voices on their mobile telephones.
"Have you got a suspect?"
a reporter from Swedish radio called out. Ekstrom raised his voice.
"If you would refrain from interrupting my statement, we'll get to that. This evening a person has been named whom the police want to question in connection with these three murders.
Will you give us his name, please?"
"It's not a he, but a she. The police are looking for a 26-year-old woman who has a connection to the owner of the weapon, and whom we know to have been at the scene of the murders in Enschede."
Bublansky frowned and then looked sullen. They had reached the point in the agenda over which he and Ekstrom had disagreed, namely the question of whether they should name their suspect. Ekstrom had maintained that according to all available documentation, Salander was a mentally ill, potentially violent woman, and that something had apparently triggered a murderous rage. There was no guarantee that the violence was at an end, and therefore it was in the public interest that she be named and apprehended as soon as possible. Bublansky held that there was reason to wait at least for results of the technical examination of Bjorman's apartment before the investigative team committed itself unequivocally to one approach, but Ekstrom had prevailed. Ekstrom held up a hand to interrupt the buzzing of the assembled reporters. The revelation that a woman was being sought for three murders would go off like a bomb. He passed the microphone to Bublansky, who cleared his throat twice, adjusted his glasses, and stared hard at the paper with the wording they had agreed on.
"The police are searching for a 26-year-old woman by the name of Lisbeth Salander. A photograph from the passport office will be distributed. We do not know where she is at present, but we believe that she is in the greater Stockholm area. The police would like the public's assistance in finding this woman as soon as possible. Lisbeth Salander is 4 feet 11 inches tall, with a slim build."
He took a deep, nervous breath. He could feel the dampness under his arms.
"Lisbeth Salander had previously been in the care of a psychiatric clinic and is regarded as dangerous to herself and to the public. We would emphasize that we cannot say unequivocally that she is the killer, but circumstances dictate that we question her immediately to ascertain what knowledge she may have about the murders in Enschede and at Odenplan."
"You can't have it both ways," shouted a reporter from an evening paper. "Either she's a murder suspect or she isn't."
Bublansky gave Ekstrom a helpless look.
"The police are investigating on a broad front, and of course we're looking at various scenarios. But there is reason to suspect the woman we have named, and the police consider it extremely urgent that she is taken into custody. She is a suspect due to forensic evidence which emerged during the investigation of the crime scene."
"What sort of evidence?"
someone in the crowded room immediately asked.
"We are not going to go into it."
Several reporters started talking at once. Ekstrom held up his hand and pointed to a reporter from Dagens Eko. He had dealt with him before and regarded him as objective.
"Inspector Bublansky said that Fröken Salander had been in a psychiatric clinic. Why was that?" "This woman had a troubled upbringing, and encountered over the years a number of problems. She is under guardianship, and the person who owned the weapon was her guardian."
"Who is he?"
"The individual who was shot in his apartment at Odenplan. At present we are withholding his name until his next of kin are notified." "What motive did she have for the murders?"
Bublansky took the microphone and said,
"We will not speculate as to possible motives."
"Does she have a police record?"
"Yes."
Then came a question from a reporter with a deep, distinctive voice that could be heard over the crowd.
"Is she dangerous to the public?"
Ekstrom hesitated for a moment. Then he said,
"We have reports which indicate that she could be considered prone to violence in stressful situations. We are issuing this statement because we want to get in touch with her as soon as possible."
Boblansky bit his lower lip.
Criminal Inspector Sonia Murdig was still in Advocate Bjurman's apartment at 9 that evening. She had called home to explain the situation to her husband. After 11 years of marriage, he had accepted that her job was never going to be 9 to 5. She was sitting at Bjurman's desk and reading through the papers that she had found in the drawers when she heard a knock on the door and turned to see Officer Bubble balancing 2 cups of coffee on his notebook with a blue bag of cinnamon rolls from the local kiosk in his other hand. Wearily, she waved him in.
"What don't you want me to touch?"
Boblansky said.
"The techs are finished in here. They're working in the kitchen and the bedroom. The body's still in there."
Boblansky pulled up a chair and sat down. Murdig opened the bag and took out a roll.
"Thanks. I was having such caffeine withdrawal I thought I'd die."
They munched quietly. Murdig licked her fingers and said,
"I heard things didn't go so well at Lundegarten."
"There was nobody there. There were unopened letters for Salander, but someone called Miriam Wu lives there. We haven't found her yet, either."
"Who is she?"
"Don't really know. Fasta is working on her background. She was added to the contract about a month ago, but she just seems to be someone who lives in the apartment. I think Salander moved without finding a change of address."
"Maybe she planned all this."
"What? A triple murder?"
Boblansky shook his head dejectedly.
"What a mess this is turning into. Ekstrom insisted on holding a press conference, and now we're going to get it in the neck from the media. Have you found anything?"
"Apart from Bjurman's body in the bedroom, you mean?
We found the empty box for the Magnum. It's being checked for prints. Bjurman has a file with copies of his monthly reports about Salander that he sent to the guardianship agency. If they're to be believed, Salander is a regular little angel. Big time."
"Not him, too,"
Boblansky said.
"Not him, too, what?"
"Another admirer of Fruken Salander."
Boblansky summed up what he had learned from Armansky and Blomqvist. Murdig listened without interrupting. When he finished, she ran her fingers through her hair and rubbed her eyes.
"That sounds completely absurd," she said.
Boblansky tugged on his lower lip. Murdig glanced at him and had to suppress a smile. He had a rough, chiselled face that looked almost brutal. But when he was confused or unsure of something, his expression turned sullen. It was in those moments that she thought of him as Officer Bubble. She had never used the nickname to his face and did not know who had coined it, but it suited him perfectly.
"How sure are we?"
"The prosecutor seems sure. An APB went out nationally for Salander this evening," Boblansky said. "She spent the past year abroad, and it's possible she could try to leave again."
"But how sure are we?"
He shrugged.
"We've taken people in for a lot less."
"Her prints were on the murder weapon in Enschede. Her guardian was murdered. Without trying to get ahead of things, I'm guessing it's the same weapon that was used here." "We'll know tomorrow. The techs found a fairly intact bullet fragment in the bed frame."
"Good.
There are some rounds for the revolver in the bottom desk drawer. Bullets with uranium cores and gold tips."
"Very useful."
"We have lots of paperwork that says Salander is unstable. Bjurman was her guardian, and he owned the gun."
Boblansky
said glumly.
"We have a link between Salander and the couple in Enschede, Mikael Blomqvist."
He said again.
"You don't sound convinced."
"I can't get a clear line on Salander. The paperwork says one thing, but Armansky and Blomqvist say something else. According to the paperwork, she is a developmentally disabled near-psychopath. According to the 2 men who have worked with her, she's a skilled researcher. There's a huge discrepancy. We have no motive for Bjurman, and nothing to say that she knew the couple in Enschede."
"How much of a motive does a psychotic nutcase need?"
"I haven't been in the bedroom yet. How does it look?"
"I found the body prostrate against the bed. He was kneeling on the floor as if he were saying his prayers. He's naked. Shot in the back of the neck."
"One shot? Just like at Enschede?"
"As far as I could see. It seems that Salander, if she's the one who did it, forced him onto his knees by the bed before she fired. The bullet went up through the back of the head and exited through his face.
Like an execution, then?
Precisely.
I was thinking, somebody must have heard the shot.
His bedroom overlooks the rear courtyard, and the neighbours above and below had left for the holiday. The window was closed. Besides, she used a pillow to muffle the sound.
Smart thinking.
At that moment, Gunnar Samuelson from Forensics stuck his head in the door.
Hi, Bubble,
he said, and then turned to his colleague.
Murdig, we were thinking of removing the body, so we turned him over. There's something you ought to take a look at.
They all went into the bedroom. Bierman's body had been placed on its back on a wheeled stretcher, the first stop on the way to the pathologist. There was no doubt about the cause of death. His forehead bore a wound 4 inches across, and a large part of his skull was hanging by a flap of skin. The blood splattered across the bed and the wall told the tale. Boblansky pouted.
"What are we supposed to be looking at?" Murdig asked.
Samuelson lifted the plastic sheet which covered Bierman's lower body. Boblansky put on his glasses when he and Murdig stepped closer to read the text tattooed on Bierman's abdomen. The letters were irregular and clumsy. Obviously, whoever wrote them was a novice tattoo artist, but the message could not have been clearer. I am a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist. Murdig and Boblansky looked at each other in astonishment.
Are we possibly looking at a motive? Murdig said at last.
Blomqvist bought a pasta meal from the 7-Eleven on his way home and put the paper carton in the microwave as he undressed and stood under the shower for 3 minutes. He got a fork and ate standing up, right out of the carton. He was hungry, but he had no appetite for food. He just wanted to take it on board as fast as he could. When it was finished, he opened a Westfin Pilsner beer and drank it straight from the bottle. Without turning on a lamp, he stood by the window, overlooking Gamlastan for more than 20 minutes, while he tried to stop thinking. 24 hours ago, he had been at his sister's house when Svensson had called him on his mobile. He and Johansson had still been alive. Blomqvist had not slept for 36 hours, and the days when he could skip a night's sleep with impunity were long gone. And he knew that he would not be able to sleep without thinking about what he had seen. The images from Enschede felt ingrained in his memory for all time. Finally, he turned off his mobile and crept under the covers. At 11 he was still awake. He got up and brewed some coffee. He put on the CD player and listened to Debbie Harry singing Maria. He wrapped himself in a blanket and sat on the living room sofa and drank coffee while he worried about Salander. What did he actually know about her? Hardly anything. She had a photographic memory, and she was a hell of a hacker. He knew that she was a peculiar, introverted woman who didn't like to talk about herself, and that she had absolutely no trust in authority of any kind. She could be viciously violent. He owed his life to that. But he had had no idea that she had been declared incompetent, or was under guardianship, or that she had spent any part of her teenage years in a psychiatric clinic. He had to choose whose side he was on. Sometime after midnight he decided that he couldn't accept the police's assumption that she had murdered Svensson and Johansson. At the very least, he owed her a chance to explain herself before he passed judgment. He had no idea when he nodded off, but at 4:30 a.m. he woke up on the sofa. He staggered into the bedroom and fell instantly back to sleep. Chapter 16. Good Friday, March 25th, to Easter Saturday, March 26th. Erickson leaned back into Blomqvist's sofa. Without thinking, she put her feet up on the coffee table, exactly as she would have done at home, and quickly took them off again. Blomqvist gave her a smile. "That's okay," he said. "Make yourself at home." She grinned and put her feet up again. On Good Friday, Blomqvist had brought the copies of Svensson's papers from the Millennium offices to his apartment. He had laid out the material on the floor of the living room, and he and Erickson had spent 8 hours going through emails, notes, jottings in Svensson's notebook, and above all the manuscript of the book. On Saturday morning, Annika Giannini had come to see her brother. She brought the evening newspapers from the day before with their glaring headlines and a huge reproduction of Salander's passport photograph on the front page. One read, "Wanted for Triple Murder." The other had opted for the more sensational headline, "Police Hunt Psychotic Mass Murderer." They talked for an hour, during which Blomqvist explained his relationship with Salander and why he couldn't believe that she was guilty. Finally, he asked his sister whether she would consider representing Salander, if or when she was caught.
"I've represented women in various cases of violence and abuse, but I'm not really a criminal defence lawyer," she said.
"You're the shrewdest lawyer I know, and Lisbeth is going to need somebody she can trust. I think in the end she would accept you." Annika thought for a while before reluctantly agreeing to at least have a discussion with Salander, if they ever got to that stage. At 1 on Saturday afternoon, Inspector Murdig called and asked if she could come over to pick up Salander's shoulder bag. The police had evidently opened and read the letter he sent to Salander's address on Lundegarten. Murdig arrived only 20 minutes later, and Blomqvist asked her to have a seat with Eriksson at the table in the living room. He went into the kitchen and took the bag down from the shelf next to the microwave. He hesitated a moment, then opened the bag and took out the hammer and the mace canister. Withholding evidence. Mace was an illegal weapon, and possession was a punishable offence. The hammer would only serve to support those who believed in Salander's violent tendencies. That wasn't necessary, Blomqvist thought. He offered Murdig some coffee.
"May I ask you some questions?" the inspector said.
"Please."
"In your letter to Salander, which my colleagues found at Lundegarten, you wrote that you are in her debt. What exactly did you mean by that?"
"Lisbeth Salander did me an enormous favour."
"What manner of favour was that?"
"It was a favour, strictly between her and me, which I don't intend to discuss."
Murdig looked at him intently.
"This is a murder investigation we're carrying out here."
"And I hope that you will catch the bastard who killed Doug and Mia as soon as possible."
"You don't think Salander is that killer?"
"No, I do not."
"In that case, who do you think did shoot your friend?"
"I don't know. But Doug was intending to expose a large number of people who had a great deal to lose. One of them could be the killer."
"And why would such a person also shoot the lawyer, Niels Bjurman?"
"I don't know. At least not yet."
His gaze was steady with his own conviction. Murdig suddenly smiled. She knew that he was nicknamed Kalle Blomqvist after the detective in Astrid Lindgren's books. Now she understood why.
"But you intend to find out?"
"If I can. You can tell that to Inspector Boblansky."
"I'll do that. And if Salander gets in touch, I hope you'll let us know."
"I don't expect her to contact me and confess that she's guilty of the murders, but if she does, I'll do everything I can to persuade her to give herself up. In that case, I would support her in any way I can. She's going to need a friend."
"And if she says she's not guilty?"
"Then I just hope she can shed some light on what happened."
"Herr Blomqvist, just between us, and off the record, I hope you realize that Lisbeth Salander has to be apprehended. Don't do anything stupid if she gets in touch with you. If you're wrong, and she is responsible for these killings, it could be extremely dangerous for you."
Blomqvist nodded.
"I hope we won't have to put you under surveillance. You know, of course, that it is illegal to give help to a fugitive. Aiding and abetting anyone wanted for murder is a serious offence."
"For my part, I hope that you will devote some time to looking at the possibility that Salander had nothing to do with these killings."
"We will." "Next question. Do you happen to know what sort of computer Doug Svensson worked on?"
"He had a second-hand Mac iBook 500. White, with a 14-inch screen. Just like mine, but with a larger display."
Blomqvist pointed to his machine on the table next to them.
"Do you have any idea where he kept it?"
"He usually carried it in a black bag. I assume it's in his apartment."
"It's not. Could it be at the office?"
"No. I've been through his desk and it definitely isn't there."
They sat in silence for a moment.
"Do I take it that Dag's computer is missing?" Blomqvist said at last.
Blomqvist and Eriksson had made a list of the people who might theoretically have had a motive for killing Svensson. Each name had been written on large sheets of paper that Blomqvist taped up on his living room wall. All of them were men, either Johns or pimps, and they all appeared in the book. By 8 that night they had 37 names, of which 30 were readily identified. 7 had been given pseudonyms in Svensson's text.
21 of the men identified were Johns who on various occasions had exploited one or another of the girls. The practical problem, from the point of view of whether they should publish the book, was that many of the claims were based on information that only Svensson or Johansson possessed. A writer who knew, inevitably, less about the subject would have to verify the information independently. They estimated that about 80% of the existing text could be published without any great problems, but a good deal of legwork was going to have to be done before Millennium could risk publishing the remaining 20%. They didn't doubt the accuracy of the contents, but weren't sufficiently familiar with the detailed work behind the book's most explosive findings. If Svensson were still alive, they would have been able to publish without question. He and Johansson could have easily dealt with and refuted any objections. Blomqvist looked out the window. Night had fallen, and it was raining. He asked if Eriksson wanted more coffee. She did not.
"We've got the manuscript under control," she said, "but we aren't any closer to pinpointing Dagenmir's killer."
"It could be one of the names on the wall," Blomqvist said.
"It could be somebody who doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with the book. Or it could be your girlfriend."
"Lisbeth," Blomqvist said. Eriksson stole a glance at him. She had worked at Millennium for 18 months. She joined right in the middle of the chaos of the Wennerström affair. After years of temp jobs, Millennium was her first full-time position. She was doing splendidly. Working at Millennium was status. She had a close bond with Berger and the rest of the staff, but she had always felt a little uncomfortable in Blomqvist's company. There was no clear reason for it, but of all the people at Millennium, Blomqvist was the one she found the most reserved and unapproachable. During the past year, he had been coming in late and sitting in his office by himself a lot, or in Berger's office. He had often been away, and during her first few months at the magazine, she seemed to see him more frequently on some sofa in a TV studio than in real life. He did not encourage small talk, and from the comments she heard from other staff members, he appeared to have changed. He was quieter and harder to talk to.
"If I'm going to work on trying to figure out why Dagenmir was shot, I'll have to know more about Salander. I don't really know where to start. If..."
She left the sentence hanging. Blomqvist looked at her. Finally, he sat down in the armchair at 90 degrees to her and put his feet up next to hers. "Do you like working at Millennium?" he said, disconcertingly.
"I mean, you've been working for us for a year and a half now, but I've been running around so much that we've never had a chance to get to know each other."
"I like working there a lot," she said. "Are you happy with me?"
"Erika and I have said over and over that we've never had such a valuable managing editor. We think you're a real find."
"Oh, forgive me for not telling you as much before now."
Eriksson smiled contentedly. Praise from the great Blomqvist was extremely gratifying.
"But that's not what I was actually asking about," she said.
"You're wondering about Lisbeth Salander's links with Millennium."
"You've never said anything, and Erika is pretty tight-lipped about her."
Blomqvist met her gaze. He and Berger might have complete confidence in her, but there were things he just could not discuss.
"I agree with you," he said. "If we're going to dig into the murders, you're going to need more information. I'm a first-hand source, and also the link between Lisbeth and Dagenmir. Go ahead and ask me questions, and I'll answer them as best I can. And when I can't answer, I'll say so."
"Why all the secrecy? Who is Lisbeth Salander, and what does she have to do with Millennium in the first place?"
"This is how it is. 2 years ago, I hired her as a researcher for an extremely complicated job. That's the problem. I can't tell you what she worked on for me. Erika knows what it was, and she's bound by confidentiality."
2 years ago. That was before you cracked Wennerström. Should I assume that she was doing research connected with that case?"
"No, you shouldn't assume that. I'm neither going to confirm or deny it. But I can tell you that I hired Lisbeth for an altogether different project, and that she did an outstanding job."
"Okay. That's when you were living like a hermit in Hedestad, as far as I've heard. And Hedestad didn't exactly go unnoticed on the media map that summer. Harriet Wanger resurfacing from the dead and all that. Strangely enough, we at Millennium haven't written a word about her resurrection."
"The reason we didn't write about Harriet is that she's on our board. We'll let the rest of the media scrutinize her. And as far as Salander is concerned, take my word for it when I tell you that what she did for me in the earlier project
has absolutely no bearing on what happened in Enschede.
I do take your word for it.
Let me give you a piece of advice. Don't guess. Don't jump to conclusions. Just accept that she worked for me and that I cannot and will not discuss what it involved. She did something else for me. During that time, she saved my life. Literally.
Erickson looked up in surprise. She had not heard a word about that at Millennium. So that means you know her rather well.
As well as anyone can know Lisbeth Salander, I suppose, Blomqvist said. She is the most introverted person I've ever met.
He sprang to his feet and looked out into the darkness.
I don't know if you want one, but I think I'll make myself a vodka and lime juice, he said at last.
Sounds much better than another cup of coffee.
Armansky spent the Easter weekend at his cabin on the island of Blidu, thinking about Salander. His children were grown up and had chosen not to spend the holiday with their parents. Ritva, his wife of 25 years, noticed that he seemed sometimes far away. He would subside into silent brooding and answered absent-mindedly when she spoke to him. He drove every day to the nearest shop to buy the newspapers. He would sit by the window on the veranda and read about the hunt for Salander. Armansky was disappointed that he had so terribly misjudged her. He had known for several years that she had mental problems. The idea that she could be violent and seriously injure someone who was threatening her did not surprise him. The idea that she had attacked her guardian, whom she would without a doubt perceive as someone who meddled in her affairs, was understandable. She viewed any attempt to control her life as provocative and possibly hostile. On the other hand, he could not for the life of him understand what would have prompted her to murder two people who, according to all available information, were utterly unknown to her. Armansky kept waiting for a link to be established between Salander and the couple in Enschede. But no such link was reported in the newspapers. Instead, there was speculation that the mentally ill woman must have had some sort of breakdown. Twice he telephoned Inspector Bublansky and asked about developments, but not even the director of the investigation could give him a connection. Blomqvist knew both Salander and the couple, but there was nothing to suggest that Salander knew or had even heard of Svensson and Johansson. If the murder weapon had not had her fingerprints on it, and had there not been an unchallengeable link to Bjurman, the police would have been fumbling in the dark.
So let's sum up, Erickson said. The assignment is to find out whether Salander murdered Doug and Mia as the police claim. Where to begin?
Look at it as an excavation job. We don't have to do our own police investigation, but we do have to stay on top of what the police uncover and worm out of them what they know. It'll be just like any other job, except that we don't necessarily have to publish everything we find out.
But if Salander is the killer, there has to be a significant connection between her and Doug and Mia. And the only connection so far is you.
And in fact, I'm no connection at all. I haven't talked to Lisbeth in more than a year. How could she have known that...
Blomqvist suddenly stopped. Lisbeth Salander, the world-class hacker. It dawned on him that his iBook was full of correspondence with Svensson, as well as various versions of the book and a file containing Johansson's thesis. He couldn't know if Salander was checking his computer. But what possible reason could she have to shoot Svensson and Johansson? What they were working on was a report about violence against women, and Salander should have encouraged them in every way, if Blomqvist knew her at all.
"You look like you've thought of something," Erickson said.
He had no intention of telling her about Salander's talents with computers.
"No, I'm just tired and going a little off the rails," he said.
"Well, now, your Lisbeth is suspected of killing not only Doug and Mia, but also her guardian, and in that case the connection is crystal clear. What do you know about him?"
"Not a thing. I never heard his name. I didn't even know she had a guardian."
"But the likelihood of someone else having murdered all three of them is negligible. Even if someone killed Doug and Mia because of their story, there wouldn't be the slightest reason for whoever it was to kill Salander's guardian as well."
"I know, and I've worried myself sick over it. But I can imagine one scenario, at least, where an outside person might murder Doug and Mia, as well as Lisbeth's guardian."
"And what's that?"
"Let's say that Doug and Mia were murdered because they were rooting around in the sex trade, and Lisbeth had somehow gotten involved as a third party. If Bjurman was Lisbeth's guardian,
then there's a chance that she confided in him, and he thereby became a witness to or obtained knowledge of something that subsequently led to his murder.
I see what you mean, Erickson said. But you don't have a grain of evidence for that theory.
No, not one grain.
So what do you think? Is she guilty or not?
Blomqvist thought for a long time. You're asking me if she's capable of murder? The answer is yes. Salander has a violent streak. I've seen her in action when...
When she saved your life?
Blomqvist looked at her, then said, I can't tell you the circumstances, but there was a man who was going to kill me, and he was just about to succeed. She stepped in and beat him senseless with a golf club.
And you haven't told the police any of this?
Absolutely not. And this has to remain between you and me. He gave her a sharp look. Marlin, I have to be able to trust you on this.
I won't tell anyone about anything we discuss. You're not just my boss. I like you, too. And I don't want to do anything that would hurt you.
I'm sorry.
Stop apologizing.
He laughed and then turned serious again. I'm convinced that if it had been necessary, she would have killed that man to protect me. But at the same time, I believe she's quite rational. Peculiar, yes, but completely rational according to her own scheme of things. She used violence because she had to, not because she wanted to. To kill someone, she would have to be exceedingly threatened or provoked. He thought for a while. Erickson watched him patiently.
I can't explain the lawyer. I don't know a thing about him. But I just can't imagine her being threatened or provoked at all by Dagan Mir. It's not possible.
They sat quietly for a long time. Erickson looked at her watch and saw that it was 9:30.
It's late. I have to be getting home.
It's been a long day. We can go on sifting tomorrow. No, leave the dishes. I'll take care of it. On the Saturday night before Easter, Armansky lay awake listening to Ritva sleeping. He could not make sense of the drama. In the end he got up, put on his slippers and dressing gown, and went into the living room. The air was cool, and he put a few pieces of wood in the soapstone stove, opened a beer, and sat looking out at the dark waters of the Furusund Channel.
What do I know?
Salander was unpredictable. No doubt about that. Something had happened in the winter of 2003 when she stopped working for him and disappeared on her year-long sabbatical abroad. Blomqvist was somehow mixed up in her sudden departure, but he didn't know what had happened to her either. She came back and had come to see him. Claimed that she was financially independent, which presumably meant that she had enough to get by for a while. She had been regularly to see Palmgren. She had not been in touch with Blomqvist. She had shot 3 people, 2 apparently unknown to her.
It doesn't make any sense.
Armansky took a gulp of his beer and lit a cigarillo. He had a guilty conscience, and that contributed to his bad mood. When Bublansky had been to see him, Armansky had unhesitatingly given him as much information as he could so that Salander could be caught. He had no doubt that she had to be caught, and the sooner the better. Armansky was a realist. If the police told him that a person was suspected of murder, the chances were that it was true. So Salander was guilty. But the police weren't taking into account whether she might have felt her actions were justified, or whether there might be some mitigating circumstance, or a reasonable explanation for her having gone berserk. The police were required to catch her and prove that she had fired the shots, not dig into her psyche. They would be satisfied if they could find a motive, but failing that, they were ready to call it an act of insanity. He shook his head. He could not accept that she was an insane mass murderer. Salander never did anything against her will, or without thinking through the consequences.
Peculiar?
Yes.
Insane? No.
So there had to be an explanation, no matter how obscure it might appear to anyone who did not know her. At around 2 in the morning, he made a decision. Chapter 17. Easter Sunday, March 27th, to Tuesday, March 29th. Armansky got up early on Sunday after hours of worrying. He padded downstairs without waking Ritva and made coffee and a sandwich. Then he opened his laptop. He opened the report form that Milton Security used for personal investigations. He typed in as many facts as he could think of about Salander's personality. At 9, Ritva came down and poured herself coffee. She wondered what he was doing. He gave a non-committal answer and kept writing. He was going to be a lost cause all day. Blomqvist turned out to be wrong, probably because it was Easter weekend and police headquarters were still relatively empty. It took until Sunday morning before the media discovered that he was the one who had found Svensson and Johansson. The first to call was a reporter from Aftonbladet, an old friend.
"Hello, Blomqvist. It's Niklasson."
"Hello, Niklasson."
"So you were the one who found the couple in Enskede?"
Blomqvist confirmed that was true.
"My source tells me they worked for Millennium."
"Your source is part right and part wrong. Dag Svensson was doing a freelance report for Millennium. Mia Johansson wasn't working for us."
"Oh, boy. This is a hell of a story, you've got to admit."
"I know," Blomqvist said wearily.
"Why haven't you released a statement?"
"Dag was a colleague and a friend. We thought it would be best, at least, to tell his and Mia's relatives what happened before we put out any story." Blomqvist knew that he wouldn't be quoted on that point.
"That makes sense. What was Dag working on?"
"A story we commissioned."
"What about?"
"What sort of scoop are you planning at Aftonbladet?"
"So it was a scoop?"
"Screw you, Niklasson."
"Oh, come on, Blomman. You think the murders had anything to do with the story Dag Svensson was working on?"
"You call me Blomman one more time and I'm hanging up and not talking to you for the rest of the year."
"All right, I'm sorry. Do you think Dag was murdered because of his work as an investigative journalist?"
"I have no idea why Dag was murdered."
"Did the story he was working on have anything to do with Lisbeth Salander?"
"No. Nothing whatsoever."
"Did Dag know that nutcase?"
"I have no idea."
"Dag wrote a bunch of articles on computer crime recently. Was that the type of story he was writing for Millennium?"
"You just won't give up, will you?" Blomqvist thought. He was about to tell Niklasson to piss off when he sat bolt upright in bed. He had just had 2 great ideas. Niklasson started to say something else. "Hold on, Niklasson. Don't move, I'll be right back." Blomqvist got up and held his hand over the mouthpiece. He was suddenly on a completely different planet. Ever since the murders, he had been racking his brains about how he could find a way to get in touch with Salander. There was a chance, a rather good chance, that she would read what he said to the newspapers wherever she was. If he denied that he knew her, she might interpret that to mean that he had abandoned her or betrayed her. If he defended her, then other people would interpret it as meaning that he knew more about the murders than he had said. But if he made a statement in just the right way, it might give Salander an impulse to reach him.
"Sorry, I'm back. What did you say?"
"Was Dag writing about computer crime?"
"If you want a soundbite from me, I'll give you one."
"Go for it."
"Only if you quote me word for word."
"How else would I quote you?"
"I'd rather not answer that question."
"So what do you want to say?"
"I'll email it to you in 15 minutes.
"What?"
"Check your email," Blomqvist said, and hung up. He went over to his desk and booted up his iBook. He opened Word and sat there concentrating for 2 minutes before he started writing.
Millennium's editor-in-chief, Erika Berger, is deeply shaken by the murder of freelance journalist and colleague Dag Svensson. She hopes that the murders will soon be solved. It was Millennium's publisher, Mikael Blomqvist, who discovered Dag Svensson and his girlfriend murdered last Wednesday night. "Dag Svensson was a fantastically gifted journalist and a person I liked a lot. He had proposed several ideas for articles. Among other things, he was working on a major investigation into illegal computer hacking," Mikael Blomqvist tells Aftonbladet. Neither Blomqvist nor Berger will speculate about who might be guilty of the murders or what motive might lie behind them. Blomqvist picked up the telephone and called Berger.
"Hi, Ricky. You've just been interviewed by Aftonbladet."
"Do tell."
He read her the quote.
"How come?"
"Every word is true. Dag has worked freelance for 10 years, and one of his specializations was computer security. I discussed it with him many times, and we were considering running an article by him on it when we finished the trafficking story. And do you know anyone else who is interested in hacking?"
Berger realized what he was trying to do.
"Smart, Mika. Damned smart. Okay, run it.
Niklasson called back a minute after he got Blomqvist's email.
That's not much of a soundbite.
That's all you're getting, and it's more than any other paper will get. You run the whole quote, or nothing. Blomqvist went back to his iBook.